welcome to Avi's Conversational Corner, a podcast on history, culture, and politics in a broad perspective. I'm your host, Avi Wolf. You can find this and other episodes like it on Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, Spotify, and YouTube, and you can help support the podcast through Patreon. It was a time of rapid, terrifying, and exhilarating change. A time of scientific breakthroughs, mass politics, endless scandals, and efforts at reform. A time when new groups of Americans fought for and sometimes won their right to participate fully in American life, while others did their best to try and keep America as it was, or as they imagined it to be. With few heroes, many villains, great geniuses, and piercing questions, many of which still trouble us today. Welcome to Stumbling Colossus, a regular part of Avi's Conversational Corner, covering the Gilded and Progressive Ages of the United States, from the end of the Civil War to the end of the First World War. This episode's topic, did the poor get poorer while the rich got richer? There's nothing surer. The rich get rich and the poor get poorer. This chorus to a popular foxtrot song known as Ain't We Got Fun, produced in the 1920s, but certainly expressing views that existed beforehand in our era, has haunted understanding of the Gilded Age to this day. Even people who will concede that the Gilded Age witnessed America becoming the wealthiest country on earth will argue that it was only the robber barons, the magnates, the bankers, the finance men who benefited, the 1% who lived on Easy Street while everyone else barely got by and never saw their life improve. Even the PBS Gilded Age documentary, which generally had some nice things to say about the capitalist effort, fell into that trap, in my opinion. But how accurate is that picture? Were things really so awful for the average American in this time of industry and money-making? Today, I'm going to do another solo episode to try and explain how, while there is truth to some of the critiques of this era, they go way too far, and that, on average, things were getting better for average American men and women. Maybe not fast enough, maybe not evenly enough, but enough that the poor, on the whole, were also getting richer in many ways. Once again, I ask the listener's patience as to the pace of this episode, as I am still getting used to doing episodes on my own and without someone to speak to. So as I said before, the common view of the Gilded Age is an era in which the people who owned the railroads, the factories, the people who loaned the money, these were the people who made a ton, who built mansions, had fancy parties, and just in general enjoyed the wealth that made the country great, while the average American man and woman, the new factory worker, the farmer, the mechanic, and all sorts of other people, generally did not see their life improve and even saw it worsen in awful conditions. Before I address this argument as a general rule, I would like to offer a number of important things we need to remember when discussing the Gilded Age in general. First of all, we do not possess the kind of detailed and minute statistics that we have today regarding people's income, their property value, and the relative size of the different classes and even sometimes the different professions. There were government statistics that were collected about some professions, and there was some degree of income reporting and consumer surveys, but nothing quite like today. Remember, until 1913, there was no federal income tax, and thus no requirement to report to a centralized authority about how much money you made, no matter how honest you were or weren't. And census records, while they are very useful to get a snapshot of how things changed every 10 years, can only tell us so much about what happened in between those 10 years. Did everything stay the same? Did they gradually get better? Did they yo-yo up and down? Sometimes we can know these things, but sometimes we can't. So when I speak later in the episode regarding the different groups of Americans, understand that I am painting with a broad brush because, frankly, I and anybody who talks about this period have no other choice. That's number one. Number two, this was not an era in which everybody had the equal opportunity to get ahead. Not only discriminatory laws, but also very powerful discriminatory custom prevented large numbers of Americans from being able to try their hand at any profession they thought themselves good at, ready to rise or fall on their own talent. The most obvious example of this, of course, are Black Americans. Black men and women who had been recently freed from slavery after the Civil War, and even people who had been freed blacks their whole life and lived in the North, were often limited in the kinds of jobs they could have and the kind of education they could have. It was simply a given that there were all sorts of professions, especially professions where they could be bosses of white men or white women. It was simply a given that they would not be given those, or if they did, that they would be the exception. And it was not just them. Many minorities who did not come from Europe, Chinese Americans, Hispanic Americans, and others who often helped to build the United States, often found themselves badly underpaid and deliberately so, subject to all kinds of mistreatment, which I believe even the world's biggest libertarians would not tolerate or put up with. And even the people who were technically also white, people who came from Ireland or from Italy or from all sorts of other places which were not part of what nativists believed to be core America, this being Britain, Scotland, the Netherlands, France, parts of Germany, were also often subject to discrimination in a variety of ways, not just through law, but also through custom. Now, in my opinion, and I think that the data and what we know bears us out, new opportunities opened up for all these populations as well. It took a while. It often took struggle. Sometimes it took the creation of new industries where perhaps there was such a need for work that bosses or people who owned companies were willing to ignore various tendencies towards discrimination. But things were also getting better for them, but they were certainly not getting better for them as easily or as quickly as native white Americans. They weren't called WASPs at the time, but people who considered themselves fully American and who considered everybody else to be less so. The other very large group, and arguably the one in the majority, would be American women. Even native-born American women faced the reality that a lot of professions were barred to them, or they needed to fight very hard to get to be accepted into them, including things such as being a lawyer. And even those jobs that were available to women who were unmarried, the very strong social expectation was that once you married, you stopped working and you cared for the children and the home and the hearth. So married women, they sometimes, and in many cases, had to make money in some way or fashion regardless, because often the family needed the income to be able to live. But they definitely faced serious obstacles that only really started to start weakening during the effort to gain women the vote and to break down those barriers in a long process that in some cases still continues today. Taking these qualifications into account, we also need to remember that the United States in the Gilded Age did not prosper evenly across the regions. As Professor Richard John said in an interview regarding the telegraph and the telephone in the United States, you're all invited to listen to the episode there. The United States in the Gilded Age was really three countries. There was the Trans-Mississippi West, all the countries, say, Montana, Nevada, California, and so forth, which remained fairly sparsely populated even with the arrival of the railroad. And some of the people who moved there enjoyed in the prosperity, some did not, but it never grew, at least in this period, into the kind of population and money-based critical mass that would allow real Gilded Age style prosperity and economic diversity, where if you didn't like one job, you could go to another. When you lived in the Trans-Pacific West, there was generally one field, whether it was mining or maybe a certain kind of very uniform agriculture, one kind of crop or what have you. And there wasn't much else for miles. That's one region. Another region, of course, is the former Confederacy or the South, a region absolutely devastated by war, with the railroads being destroyed, with the value that Southerners gaining from slavery, obviously and rightly, being destroyed with abolition, also became a region that, for various reasons, and I would like to at least do one episode on this, remained economically backward and which the Gilded Age largely passed by. And it ended up with both Black Americans and white Americans ending up being sharecroppers, almost medieval serfs, growing cotton in place of the slaves, but without the kind of good stuff and bad stuff that we traditionally remember the Gilded Age as bringing. Gilded Age America in the classical sense, we think of the factories, the railroads, the scientific inventions, the growth of the cities, overwhelmingly took place in New England, the mid-Atlantic states, and the Midwest. That was core Gilded Age America. And it is to this region which we must discuss and understand in order to understand how good or how bad the Gilded Age was for the average American. One description I often see in order to explain the problem of inequality in Gilded Age America is like this. Before the Gilded Age, indeed before the Civil War, America was a primarily small town, rural country. People knew each other. Communities were tight-knit. Yes, some farmers or professionals or mechanics did better than others, and sometimes you had people who were genuinely really wealthy, but they all lived within the same, they all lived near each other. You could ask each other for help. Local elites even helped out their local places, and there wasn't the sense that American society was coming apart or becoming alienated. It was a very intimate and a very the idealized description of how things were, but nevertheless, there was comfort in the fact that social gaps were not so great that everybody lived in a different neighborhood or a different area. Fast forward to the Gilded Age, and at least per this description, I'll explain the problems in it soon. All of a sudden, everybody is segregated, and segregated not just by race and gender, but also by class. Suddenly, the local elites and the local professionals are now replaced by really rich people who stay as far away as possible from anybody else. You have their assistants and their managers who also try their best to stay as far away as possible from everybody else. All of that, ostensibly, leaves the huge masses of workers coming in, either from the farm in the United States or from the small town in the United States or from the farm and small town in Europe and elsewhere, packing themselves into cities and barely able to get by, because the people with the wealth and who hoard the wealth are all holed up in their Tony neighborhoods or even in suburbs or mansions. That's how they describe it. Now, there are a number of problems with this description, and let me break them down. First of all, and again, as I say before, I'm doing this based on a broad brush because unfortunately we do not have the kind of overarching broad statistics I could provide in our day regarding who belongs to what class, roughly speaking. We know that this is a period in which the professional middle class actually grew and grew substantially. thanks to increasing wealth, the growth of companies, the growth of different industries, the growth of possibly expanding businesses and services, and the growth of national professional associations. Every single city worthy of the name had a substantial middle class, either overseeing overseeing workers, or providing services to all Americans. And that middle class only grew as time went on. That's number one. Number two, when we talk about workers, we need to remember that workers were not all one big monolith of completely helpless individuals who had no options and who could always be easily abused. There were cases like this, unfortunately, way too many, where that was the case. It was especially true when immigrants were called in, offered a better life in the United States, and quite often were not paid all that well or were taken advantage of. It was also true in the South, where for a bit long period after the Civil War, companies were able to exploit a system whereby Black Americans were arrested for often quite trivial crimes and then rented out as effectively a new form of slave labor to work on the railroads or in various factories. And there were other cases too. But first of all, there was a substantial and indeed growing number of people who were called, who might be called skilled workers. People who were valuable, people who had options, people who, if they didn't like one particular factory or workshop, could move to another, people who could earn a fairly good living or demand a high price. And even the people who were relatively unskilled laborers, the packing of lots of people into cities, especially New York and Chicago, but not only, any city of any reasonable size, meant you had options. If you didn't like this job, you could move to that job. If you didn't like this industry, within 5 or 10 years, maybe even less, a new industry or a new competitor was arising. And we tend to forget the fact that the Gilded Age was anything but static in terms of the creation of industries and places to work and things to train on. So that's another thing. Most importantly, though, is that this belief that the local lawyer or the local wealthy landowner was now entirely replaced by the robber baron, by the J.P. Morgans and Cornelius Vanderbilts and Jay Goulds of the world, is simply false. Local elites did not cease to exist in this period. In fact, many of them benefited from the Gilded Age and stayed where they were or helped to support local initiatives, not just in small towns, but also in the growing cities and the growing suburbs. Indeed, those local elites were often the biggest champions of change, of reform, of restraint, of the robber barons and of the big industries. And they certainly did not, and many of them certainly did not cease to serve in those core functions that people lament somehow disappeared in the Gilded Age. Far from. Another thing that's important to remember is that in the PBS documentary on the Gilded Age, it effectively mentions only two possible ways for your average American man or woman to be able to be helped financially in case of illness, in case of old age, in case of just needing some more for their family. There's either the employer, if they were generous, and many were, not all, but many were, or there's the state. This is a very common view that has been around certainly since FDR's New Deal. And once again, this is a view that is false. It's simply not true that your options were either the generosity of the employer, the generosity of the state, or the generosity of charity. In David Baedo's wonderful book, From Mutual Aid to the Welfare State, which I highly recommend reading, he shows that many Americans, including the most disadvantaged, including the most discriminated against, including the most mistreated, formed all sorts of mutual aid societies, pooled their money, and were able to provide each other with at least a modicum of a communal safety net, either based on ethnicity, based on profession, based on region, based on religion, and so on. And these things did not just give you an extra buck. You wanted to be able to find work, you could work through that local society. You wanted to be able, you wanted a doctor or even life insurance, you could often work through that society. Huge swaths of American society across the core Gilded Age America made use of these societies or knew of their existence and could enlist their aid. And that includes fraternities, by the way. For those of you who remember the Flintstones, they were part of the water buffaloes. There were many such, although I don't believe there were water buffaloes. Another thing we need to remember is that there were also many institutions that were informal that would help you out. Maybe you weren't a member of a church, but a church would help you out. Maybe you couldn't always afford to buy a beer at a saloon, but you could always go to a saloon to try and get a lead on a job or maybe some food and maybe perhaps a loan. So this is very important to remember when we discuss the Gilded Age. It was not an exclusively dog-eat-dog world where the individual or at most their family had absolutely nothing to rely on except for the generosity of charity or the generosity of the state to the extent that any state helped in this period or the generosity of their employer. Americans helped other Americans out a lot. And they did so not just the well-off, but even people who suffered. And it's important to remember this. The poor helped each other out as much as they could, just as the middle class did, and just as the rich sometimes tried to help the poor. Another thing that's important to keep in mind here is that in addition to discussing wages, which as I said before, we believe that wages were generally going up in this period, and for most of the time they did in most places. But even setting that aside, let us assume that the wages more or less stayed flat. We know from the very fact that lots of owners of companies and services and goods made enormous amounts of money, that the cost of living was going down. The robber barons may have committed many sins, but one of the things that they were absolutely obsessed with was cutting costs down to the bone. Why? Because the cheaper they made everything, the cheaper they would be available, not just to the middle class or to people in Europe, but to average Americans. The average railroad fare went down, the more even poor people could go on day excursions, the more Rockefeller made sure heating oil went down, the more Americans could heat their homes, the more you were able to ship agricultural goods all across the country, the more food costs went down. And food was a very important and is still a very important component of our lives today. So even if we do not have exact statistics, we know just by the fact that these people made so much money providing all sorts of goods and services in bulk and making an enormous profit, that lots of normal Americans living throughout the United States, and especially the core Gilded Age America, that things were getting better for them. Again, this does not mean they didn't struggle. This does not mean they didn't suffer. This doesn't mean that there weren't very real problems that reformers pointed to and sometimes solved. But it does mean that the idea that only the rich benefited, that only the rich did well, that the poor did not, that the poor, the workers, and the average American man and woman didn't really see any improvement in their lives for over 50 years, is simply not true. It's not tenable, and it's not fair. Another thing we need to remember, for instance, is that even the poor wages that immigrants were paid and they were often paid relatively poor wages in the United States. And they disproportionately manned the factories and built the railroads, even those wages were generally better than what they could get back home. From what we know, at least based on what we know, wages in the United States were generally better, except perhaps for the really richest areas of Europe, say the city of London, which at the time even eclipsed New York as the financial capital of the world. That's something that needs to be taken into consideration. But what about the small towns, right? Say, okay, you go to the cities, you suffer, it's difficult, it's cramped, but you have lots of opportunity. You can fall down and pick yourself up over and over and over again and eventually do well. What about small town America? What about that valuable part of the United States? Small town America, and again, we're speaking with a very broad brush, if we refer not to those people who lived in the South and the West, who did see improvement, but much more unevenly for reasons I mentioned and others, if we refer to small town America in the Midwest, the Northeast, and the Mid-Atlantic, they also saw their lives improve very much. How so? First of all, this was the era of the railroad. And the more railroads came in, the more small towns didn't have to rely on subsistence level farming or having to make a lot of their own stuff. Mail order services like Montgomery Ward and Sears and Roebuck, the Amazons of their day, offered almost everything they could ask for delivered, if not to their doorstep, although that would happen soon too, delivered to the nearest general store or post office. And these made it possible for many a person living in the small towns to be able to do better in whatever they did for a living. It also enabled people who didn't really care for the small town life to be able to move out and try their luck somewhere else, very often successfully. What about recessions, though? There were two very big recessions in this period, what were called at the time panics. One occurred in the year 1873, and the other occurred in the year 1893. This is another argument used against the Gilded Age because these recessions were genuinely painful, especially the panic of 1893. 1893 was quite possibly the worst recession in American history until the Great Depression of 1929. Hundreds of banks collapsed. Life savings were wiped out in so many places. Millions lost their jobs. And things looked incredibly desperate. This is all true, but we also need to remember this, that shortly after both 1873 and 1893, wherever you want to put the end of the Depression and these recessions, and this is a matter of debate among economists, wherever you want to put it though, these were followed by periods of growth, periods of prosperity, periods in which people's lives nevertheless still got better than they were before, in most places and in most cases, certainly in core Gilded Age America. In fact, core Gilded Age America was so attractive that the people living in the Trans-Mississippi West and in the South that I mentioned, who unfortunately did not enjoy the prosperity of the Gilded Age quite as much, what did they do when things really got bad? They migrated to core Gilded Age America. For instance, people who tried to homestead in Kansas but weren't able to make a go of it, they famously said, "In God we trusted, in Kansas we busted." Where did they move to? They didn't move to another place in the West or perhaps to another country or to the South. They moved to the Gilded Age cities to try their luck and to get more opportunity. People are not stupid. At least millions of people cannot be that foolish. And if there wasn't a sense that there was real opportunity to better yourself in core Gilded Age America, people would not have come. Indeed, immigrants did not always come. During the recession of 1893, there was a real slowdown in immigration because people learned through word of mouth that there was a massive recession, there weren't jobs, you couldn't make money. Once things picked up again, and they did, immigration picked up again, as did internal migration. The Great Migration of both Black Americans and White Americans from the South, after all, was to the Midwest, to the car factories, to the war industries of World War I, and other such opportunities to get away from sharecropping or hard work in the mines. Even 1893, by the time William McKinley ran against the famous populist William Jennings Bryan in 1896, McKinley was able to run, and convincingly, on a campaign that spoke of the full lunch pail. Things were getting better. The gold standard was making sure that people got jobs and people got good paying jobs, and that to play around with Bryan's radical ideas would be to destroy all that prosperity. And voters listened, and they voted for him in all the places in core Gilded Age America. You can even see it on a map. If the Gilded Age was really that terrible, if things were really that awful for the average individual, it is hard to imagine that they would have voted against McKinley. And remember, it was not just the workers who ultimately voted for him, but also many farmers. Another distorting image that is created is that because the farmers of the Great Plains and the farmers of the South suffered, and they did suffer, and there is an issue worth discussing in a separate episode, either in a conversation or perhaps as another solo episode. But the farmers in core Gilded Age America were close enough to markets of cities, had diverse enough crops and animals that they raised, and they trusted their establishment parties enough that the radical song of populism did not appeal to them. And for them, things were going well. Yes, things could always be going better, but things were going well. And that's something that's really very important to remember. The poor were getting gradually richer. The basic necessities of life were getting cheaper. Sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. New industries were opening up every single, almost every year, or certainly every decade, in which new entrants and even people who were discriminated against could give it a go, and sometimes successfully. This was an era in which all boats were lifted, even if it took a long time, certainly in core Gilded Age America. In the other regions, it was a more complicated story, and that's worth addressing. But the idea that it was exclusively a time where the rich enjoyed life and life for everybody else sucked is simply not a tenable argument. And it is frankly an insult to the intelligence of the many workers, the many immigrants, the many strivers, even among those who suffered terribly from discrimination and abuse, who believed, and often rightly, that even in that America, things could still get better, as they often did. I hope I have sufficiently explained most of the reasons why Gilded Age America was a world in which the rich were getting rich, but the poor were also getting richer. Thank you for listening. I'd like to once again remind my listeners that you can listen to this podcast on Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, Spotify, and YouTube, and you can support the podcast on Patreon. See you all next time at Avi's Conversational Corner.